Okay, so let's get started. Couple of announcements. I actually forgot to mention that I put up a homework on the course web page last time. So as I had mentioned, the first homework is not going to be graded, but it is mandatory. Everyone has to hand it in. It is based on the final exam of the undergrad operating systems class, and the reason to do it is to make sure you have reasonable background. Although that was a closed book exam, you are welcome to use a textbook to look at the questions and answer them. Okay, so it was actually due a week from last class, which was on Thursday. Since I forgot to announce that I put a homework up, it was on the web page. I just forgot to mention it here. You can take an extra day or two. Okay, it doesn't make any difference. Just send it in directly to the TA by email. Okay, you don't have to hand in hard copies, because it will be due in off class cycle. If it's due in class, you can always hand in hard copies. So just email it to the teaching assistant, Chang. Okay. So I also put up some additional readings which I'll do from time to time. So if you have the interest, go and look at those things, because they are interesting and relevant to the discussion we are having here. Right? So today we will start a new topic, processes and threads. So do keep in mind that we are making good progress through the book. This is the third chapter already. Okay, so that's around 50-60 pages of reading that you have to do. So it's a good idea to keep up with the class and not wait for an exam to then read 300 pages. Okay, so do keep up. So today we'll talk about processes and threads. And chapter 3 we are going to spend maybe 2 or 3 classes. Okay, so the first chapter and the second one we just went through very quickly. But this is where we'll start looking at issues in more detail. So today we are going to do processes and scheduling. This is mostly background from what you should already know from your undergrad operating systems class. Okay, I'm just going to do a quick recap of that material before I actually talk about multiprocessor scheduling. We'll do threads and thread scheduling. Distributed scheduling and migration will probably only get to next class. Okay, I don't think we will get there today. The first three bullets we probably will look at or discuss today. So quick review of processes. So you should all know what a process is at the very least. What is of interest to us is from an operating system standpoint or from a kernel standpoint, how does it handle the notion of a process, and we'll also look at how does it handle the notion of a thread. Okay, so the kernel data structure that is maintained for every process that is currently active is what is called the process control block, or the PCB. Okay, this keeps track of all various statistics as well as any information that the kernel needs in order to manage resources for this process and to schedule it. Okay, so it has various things like the user who created the process priority. It has pointers to the page table or the memory mappings for this process, and so on. Okay. Process itself, what does it have? It has a number of segments which include the code that the process is using, as well as data, which includes the stack segment, the heap segment, as well as shared variables. Okay, so each process, when it's loaded in memory, has a number of segments, and you basically execute the code segment, and whenever code makes a reference, you look up the stack or the heap or global variable. Okay. Any process makes, when it executes, goes through a number of state transitions. Okay, starting from when it is created, at any point it could be ready, which means it's ready to execute, but is waiting to get the CPU, to running, which means it is actually executing on the CPU, to blocked. Okay, when you are blocked on some IO and you're waiting for it to finish. So you will make these transitions for some number of time before you move to a finished state, at which point the process is going to terminate. Okay. This is pretty standard OS, undergrad OS stuff, so you should know all of this. Now, as far as the operating system is concerned, what it is doing is it is trying to schedule a number of processes using the resources on the machine. Because if the machine has only one CPU, what it does is it schedules these active processes or processes that are ready to run one at a time on the processor. Okay, and it uses the notion of a quanta to do this, where each process runs for a fixed amount of time, at which point it has to relinquish the CPU, and then another process gets to run and it has a quanta and so on. Okay, so it is going to use some scheduling algorithm in order to multiplex multiple processes on the processor. Okay, and here is just a small list of various processor scheduling algorithms, starting from round robin, which just says that you basically take the ready queue and you schedule processes in round robin order to shortest job first. Okay, so here you need to know the length of a job, which may not always be known, but you will take the shortest job and you schedule it next, and you wait for it to finish, then you schedule the next shortest job and so on. Okay, FIFO is first in, first out, and then there are a number of advanced algorithms which we'll not look at in any detail. Lottery scheduling, earliest deadline first. These are used in certain special scenarios where either you want to guarantee a certain fraction of the processor time to each process. Okay, typically scheduling is best effort. There are no guarantees made as to how much CPU time you're going to get. Okay, but there are algorithms like lottery scheduling which would guarantee that. And earliest deadline first, which is used in real-time kernels to provide timeliness guarantees. Okay, if there is a real-time constraint, then you use algorithms that are variants of EDF. Okay. Now, which algorithm would you pick to, or you as in the operating system designer would pick to schedule processes, depends on what you want the system to do. Okay, you have to choose some performance metric for your system, and that's what you're trying to optimize, and that will dictate typically what processor scheduling algorithm to pick. I already mentioned, if you want to provide some notions of guarantees on how much CPU time each process gets, then you pick either lottery scheduling or its fair share variant or earlier deadline first. But most commodity operating systems pick some variants of a best effort scheduling algorithm, and what they do is they try to either optimize the throughput of the system or try to maximize CPU utilization, or if it's an interactive system, it tries to minimize response time that user sees for interactive jobs. So these are typical performance metrics that are used to schedule processes. Yes, question there.
What is turnaround time?
Turnaround time is basically the time between when you submit a job or start a process to the time it ends, and that's referred to as the time. It's also called completion time. Okay. So process behavior, and this slide is probably has more technical detail than we really need as background, but let me go through it in any case. So typical process behavior depends on what the process is trying to do. Okay, typically most processes have alternate bursts of CPU and IO activity. Okay, if you are a CPU bound or a CPU intensive process, you are going to have long spells of CPU activity and an occasional IO, where you just run on the CPU for long periods of time and then you might do a small amount of IO and you go back to running. If you are an IO bound task, it's the opposite. You spend most of your time waiting or doing some IO activity, and you run for a short period of time and then you block on the next IO and so on. Okay? So these are the two extremes. Either you are a CPU intensive or CPU bound application, or an IO bound application. Most applications will fall somewhere in between. Okay, they could either be CPU or IO bound, but typically you may be somewhere in between, where you will alternate between some bursts of CPU and some burst of an IO. Okay, so you will run on the CPU for some amount of time, then you may be blocked for some IO, then you'll run again and so on. Okay. Now, there has been a lot of work dating back to, the 70s, where people have tried to characterize the behavior of processes and use that knowledge to come up with better scheduling algorithm. Okay, so typically what you do is you model this kind of behavior where you have CPU and IO bus using a hyper exponential distribution, which is basically shown here. And what this shows is this is a probability distribution that says once you start running on the CPU, the amount of time you will run is governed by this top sort of distribution, is hyper exponential. It says there is some mean, okay, and which is shown by the peak, but you could have certainly some processes that may have fairly long CPU bus, okay, and that somehow characterizes the average task that you see in the system. again, this is not really relevant for this class, but I just wanted to mention that there has been a lot of work on modeling process behavior as well. Okay, and then typical ones look like either look exponential or hyper exponential. Use hyper exponential distributions to model disperse.
So that distribution, does that still stand with modern application? Because the current kernels seem to have bigger.
Right. So question is, does this distribution still apply to modern applications? Applications may have changed, but their fundamental behavior still hasn't. I mean, they still have bursts of CPU and I/O. And this is just saying that they fit this distribution. The parameters of this distribution may change depending on what applications do, but that's still a fair characterization of how applications behave. Okay. So coming back to process scheduling. So if you take a typical commodity operating system, let's say a Unix flavor of an operating system, a Linux or Solaris, so what they use is they use this scheduling algorithm called a multi-level feedback queue. Okay, so what happens in this algorithm is let's take a uniprocessor system. Okay, so there's one CPU that you want to schedule all of your processes. Okay, it is assumed that each task has some priority associated with it. And depending on which priority level you are in, you will be in one of these queues. Okay, there are queues associated with priority levels, and you will be in one queue depending if you are ready. Right. Okay, so here we have showed three priority levels. Let's say priority 1, 2, and 3. This is the CPU. There are some tasks queued up here. Okay, so what you do is you always look at the highest priority queue. Okay? Whenever a quantum ends, you look at the highest priority queue. If there is a task that is ready, you will just pick that from the head of the queue and run it. Okay, and so on. If that queue becomes empty, then you will go to the next highest priority queue. If there is a task that is ready to run in that queue, you will pick that and so on. Okay, so that's the typical way you run these tasks, but there are some nice properties that have been used to design this multi-level feedback queue. And the one property is the highest price, so the quantum that you get to run on the CPU depends on your priority level. Okay? Tasks at the highest priority level, let's say you get, I'm just going to pick a number, a 10 millisecond quantum in this queue. Okay? Then you go down, you basically double that. Okay? So here you may get 20, and then you go down, you'll get 40, and so on. Okay? So the quantum length increases as the priority level decreases. This is the first thing, and it increases exponentially as the priority decreases. That's one property of this multi-level feedback queue algorithm. The other property is whenever you run in a queue, whenever you run on the CPU, if you use up your entire allocated quantum, you are actually going to be dropped down one priority level. But if you give up the CPU, you relinquish the CPU before you use your entire quantum, you will jump up one priority level. This is how the priorities will change. Priorities are not static in this scheme. They change dynamically depending on current behavior. Okay, the dynamics is basically whether you use up, whenever you run, if you use up your quantum, you rise in priority. If you don't, rather you fall in priority. But if you don't use up the quantum, you relinquish the CPU before your quantum ends, then you are going to rise. So this is basically the algorithm. Now, what does this give us? Why are there different quantum sizes? And what does this do when you basically change the priority? So why design a scheme like this? Anybody remember undergrad OS? Utilization of the CPU. What? Okay, prevent starvation. Any other thoughts? I mean, we are all pointing to the right direction. So I think what is instructive is to understand what happens to different types of processes in this algorithm. Okay, let's take a CPU bound. So let's assume that whenever you start, whenever a new process comes into the system, it starts in the highest priority queue. Okay, now let's take a CPU bound task. So what do you think will happen when that task joins the highest priority queue over time? Okay, so it will keep dropping in priority, and this is because a CPU bound task is more likely to use up its entire quantum by the definition of a CPU burn task. It runs on CPU for long periods of time, so you give it a quantum, is more likely to use it up. Okay, it's not like less likely to just stop in with the middle of a quantum and start doing IO. So if you use up your entire quantum, you're going to keep dropping. Okay? So in this scheme, CPU bound tasks actually fall to the bottom. Okay, now take an IO bound task. What would happen to an IO bound task? Okay, so it would either stay here. If it joined this queue, it would either stay here because it's more likely to relinquish the CPU in the middle of a quantum. Because by definition of an IO bound task, you do short IO bursts and you do IO, rather CPU bursts and you do IO most of the time. Okay. So it is going to either stay here, or if it has dropped down for any reason, it will keep rising. So IO bound tasks run at high priority, CPU bound tasks run at low priority. And this is effectively what you want in the system. Since an IO bound task needs the CPU for short periods of time, you want to give it priority, give it the CPU, and then have it go back to doing IO. And on the other hand, a CPU bound task should run on the CPU for long periods of time, but shouldn't starve any IO bound tasks. Okay, so that's the reason IO bound task automatically gets high priority, CPU bound tasks get low priority. And as the process dynamics change, the algorithm is going to adapt. Okay, you don't have to tell the algorithm this is an IO bound or a CPU bound task, it just infers it from the behavior, okay, by how the algorithm works. So if you are a CPU bound task, but you suddenly become IO bound, you will again go up. So that's what the algorithm will do, and if you change your behavior, you will fall down the priority. So it adjusts to the dynamics of the processes, and how as there are phase changes in application, the algorithm adapts automatically. Okay. So this is basically what is used in many flavors of Unix, okay, to schedule processes. And as you can see, it achieves multiple goals at the same time. It prefers IO bound tasks, yet it gives more CPU time to CPU bound tasks without starving IO bound tasks and so on. Okay, so that's what you do in multi-level feedback queue, also called MLFQ. Any questions here?
So can you also starve a CPU bound task if a very high priority IO bound task comes in? Like if I try to keep four, right? I want to see.
Right. So question is, can you stop an IO bound task, a CPU bound task, if a high priority task comes in? Okay. So typically, what would happen here is that whenever you get a quantum, okay, you get that quantum, but you are not interrupted until your quantum, except if there is an interrupt. Okay. Now you mentioned this notion of a keyboard. When you press a keyboard, that will generate an interrupt. An interrupt will then interrupt any task that's on the CPU, will jump to the interrupt service routine in the kernel, and it's going to service the interrupt. Okay, so that's a different problem. Except now what you are asking is, a higher priority task joins the queue, it still has to wait for the quantum to end. Okay, that's not a long quantum, it's just maybe a few tens of milliseconds before you get to run. Okay, in other words, it's not fully preemptive, unless only interrupts can preempt tasks. Any other questions here? Okay, so that brings us to the end of our review on processes, and now I'm going to talk about threads. Okay, what are threads and what do they do? And what is of interest is not just the notion of a thread, but rather from an operating system standpoint, how threads are scheduled and what does the OS need to do about threads and so on. That's what is really interesting to us from this course's perspective. Okay. So before we talk about thread, let's just look at the definition of a process, which then allows us to understand what a thread does. Okay. A traditional process basically has some address space in memory, and it has one thread of control that basically runs through this address space. And this is basically what is currently executed. So you have one thread of control through a potentially sparse address space. Okay, so just to draw a picture. Let's say this is memory. Let's see, it doesn't work. Okay, I'm so assuming this is your code segment. And I'm just going to, let's say this is function foo. This is all assembly, but I'm just going to simplify it and put some source code here. So this is some code that's loaded in the code segment. Let's say this is the stack and so on. Okay. So in the traditional process, you have the code segment and there's one thread of control that says this is where what you are executing currently. This is your program counter. Okay, and you're basically sequentially executing this program. Okay, so you will execute that instruction, then you execute the next instruction, if there are jumps or other conditional jumps, then you will basically transfer program control to that location, but you will execute the program sequentially essentially. And there's only one thread that is executing through this process. Okay. Now, the notion of a thread generalizes this concept, and it allows you to have multiple concurrent threads of execution through a that share a single address space. Okay. So, this is what a process looks like. So, in the case of a threaded program, you still have the same layout in memory. That doesn't change. What changes is that you have these multiple threads. Let's see if there's another function. So this thread is executing the code here. There's another thread that is simultaneously executing some other part of the code segment, okay, at the same time. Okay, you can have any number of these. Okay, so when this thread executes, the program counter actually points here and it's executed sequentially. And when this thread gets to run, the program counter is going to point there and it's going to execute that code sequentially and so on. So you can have any number of these in a multi-threaded application. Is this clear? The first concept of what a thread is. Okay. So what does this give us? Okay. So first is just keep in mind that all threads share the same address space. All threads in the same process or the same application share the same address space. So they basically have access to the same code. They have access to shared variables and so on. Okay. This allows you to share, as we will see in just a moment. Just a second. Okay. And then the second thing is it basically allows potentially parallel execution. Okay, you are executing this code in parallel. Each thread is executing a different part of the program. Okay, all concurrently. Yes, question.
How are the local variables pushed and popped onto the stack?
Okay, so we'll come to that in just 1 second. So question is, how are the local variable pushed and popped onto the stack? So I didn't say anything about the stack, and let me come to that actually right here. Okay, so this is the same picture that I drew there. Now, the only thing that is different from a process when you have a single threaded process. Okay, a process by definition is a single threaded process, and this is a multi-threaded process. So what is different is every thread gets its own stack. Okay, in a single threaded process, there's only one stack. That is the stack of the entire process. In a multi-threaded process, every thread has its own stack, and you need this because a stack essentially has a state of what functions are currently in the stack frame, okay, as each thread is may call some other function, and then you have to push and pop that stack, okay, independently of what some other function is doing. So this thread would basically have a stack, let's say is here, and the local way the arguments to, let's say, foo would be at the top of the stack, okay, and this thread would have its own stack, and arguments passed to bar would be on top of its stack, and so on. And when it returns from bar, it would pop that stack, and this, when this returns from foo, it would pop its stack. Okay, so the stacks are independent. Okay, also each thread would have its own program counter and its own set of registers because each is executing independently of other threads. Okay, so this state is dependent on the thread, but the rest of the address space is shared across all of the threads in your application. Does that answer your question?
But I don't understand how each thread can have its own set of registers because the number of registers is fixed.
Okay, you are asking how can a thread have its own set of registers. Okay, so this is no different from multiplexing multiple processes on one CPU. You are multiplexing multiple threads on the same CPU. If you have only one CPU, these two threads are not executing at the same time. Only one of these two is executing. And what if this, let's say, if this is the one that's executing, its registers are currently loaded in ReLIN register. And when it has to give up the CPU, you would save the state of those registers and switch to some other thread. Okay? Same as when one process runs, its state is loaded in the register, and when it relinquishes the CPU, save that state somewhere and run another process. Same thing happens here. Okay? Any other question? You have a question?
Assuming the same as that is done for process or for thread scheduling or something
else? Okay. You are asking, is thread scheduling different from process scheduling? Conceptually, it is similar. We'll talk about the differences between the two in just a moment. So whenever you want to switch from one thread to another, you have to save the state of that thread, load the state of the other thread and start running it, meaning that you will load the program counter for this thread, which would point here. You would load its registers, okay, where you have saved them somewhere in memory, you would load them into those registers and start executing. When it gives up its quantum, you would switch to some other thread. Yeah, so that we will come to. That's what we are going to talk about. The question is, what scheduling algorithm, what does it do? We'll look at that. Yes, question.
So there is a context switch penalty, right, just like the process.
Right. So
is the context switch penalty lower?
Right. So question is, context switch penalty, is it lower? So we'll talk about thread scheduling, and these are precisely the issues we are going to look at. Differences between thread and process scheduling, context switches, and so on. Because we are just maybe one or two slides ahead of the class. Okay. So before we even talk about thread scheduling, it's just instructive to understand what threads are giving us. Okay. Why develop an application in this fashion as opposed to multiple processes that interact with one another. Okay. The first reason to have multi-threaded application is if you have more than one processor in your system, then you can take advantage of this process. If you have only a single thread of control, your entire process is only going to run on one CPU. Even if there are other CPUs idle, you cannot take any advantage of it. On the other hand, if you have multiple threads and you have multiple processes, then there you can have parallel, real parallel execution. Meaning that if you have a dual core machine, this thread can run on the first core and that thread can run on the second core, assuming both are ready to run. Okay, and then you have parallel execution. Okay. So that's one thing. So you can actually extract parallelism, and this is very important because if you look at any modern architecture, the trend is towards multi-core machine. Right? Maybe 5-10 years ago, you could buy multi-processor machines where the same argument held, but multi-processor machines were not the norm. They were more of an exception, that you had to pay a lot of money for some specialized needs. Now, if you go and buy any machine, practically any machine, it will at least have two cores. And soon, in 5 years, every machine is going to have 4 or 8 cores because that's the trend. Okay? Now, if you have lots of cores and you have only single-threaded applications, then unless you have lots of applications running concurrently, you're not going to be able to take advantage of these cores. Okay? So, having multi-threaded applications gives you the benefit in this scenario. Okay, that's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing is context switches, and that was the question that was just raised. It should be clear that context switches, as far as processes are concerned, is more expensive than switching between threads of the same process. Okay? Now, why is that? What does a context switch involve? Whenever you want to switch from one process to another, you have to save the entire state of the first process, okay, into some kernel data structure, which is in main memory, and you have to load the entire state of the process that you want to run, okay, and the amount of the overhead that is incurred in doing this is referred to as the context switch overhead. Okay, now when it comes to multi-threaded applications, switching between threads is going to be cheaper because you are still within the same address space. Okay, so you don't have to save the state of the address space. I mean, the page tables are going to be the same and memory mappings remain the same. The only thing you have to do is to save the state of the registers. Okay? This is the only save state you need to save and load some other state. But all the rest of the state is the same. So context switches are substantially cheaper in multi-threaded applications. Now when you switch from a thread of process I to a thread of process J, you will have the same overhead as switching between processes. Okay? Because now you are switching processes, so your context switches are still going to be expensive. But switching between threads of the same process is much cheaper. Okay, that's one thing. Now the same is true for creation and deletions. Okay, process creation and process deletion is a heavy weight operation. It requires you to load some program into memory and set it up for execution and so on. But thread creation and thread deletion are significantly cheaper. Okay, because the process is already loaded. If you want to add a new thread using thread create, all you have to do is allocate a new stack. Okay, and allocate some space to save the registers of that process, of that thread. Okay, the address space is already active in memory. You don't incur the overhead of loading a new program into memory. Okay, so thread creation, thread deletion, cheaper. Switching between thread also cheaper, as when you compare all of these operations to processes.
So in your address space, you will leave some space for saving state, or
you're asking how thread creation works.
Yeah.
Right. So how does thread creation work? I mean, this is no different from... So you have an address space. Typically, a process gets a virtual address space that's much bigger than its real needs. Okay. So basically, let's say the stack grows, the heap is going to go, let's say the stack is growing downwards. Okay. And then this is the core segment and so on. So you have some empty virtual address space in your. So when you allocate a new thread, you are going to take some of that space and actually allocate it to a new thread. Okay? You'll have a new stack segment for that thread and so on. Right. So the third benefit is that threads have full access to the address space, which means sharing is much easier. Okay, if you want to share between processes, you have to set up something like a shared memory segment and use that to share. Okay, in this case, all threads already share the address space, so sharing is as simple as using a global variable that you can access using some synchronization primitive. Okay, so sharing becomes much simpler when you compare it to sharing between processes. And I already mentioned you can execute in parallel. Okay. So there are many benefits of implementing multi-threaded applications. So let's now consider what happens from a scheduling standpoint. Okay, then for the first thing is how do threads differ from processes? Okay. For that we look at three models. One is the single-threaded process, which we call a traditional process. A multi-threaded process is a process with multiple threads of control. And then we'll look at an event-based approach, which is also called the finite state machine approach, and try to understand how all of these work. Okay. In a traditional process, only one thread of control, whenever that thread makes any I/O operation or invokes any system call, it is going to block. Okay. And when it blocks, it has to give up the CPU until that operation completes. Okay. And it cannot use the CPU until it completes, so some other process has to run in the meantime. Okay. This is your standard blocking system called blocking I/O concept of what a process does. Okay, there is no parallelism here. There is only one thread of control. Okay. This is one extreme. In a multi-threaded application, also the same thing is true, but for an individual thread. Okay. If some thread in your application does an I/O, okay, let's say it does printf and wants to print to the screen, or it makes a system call, okay, it is also going to block. And it has to give up the CPU, just as you had in the single-threaded process. The only difference is that although that thread is blocked, other threads can still run. So the application as a whole can continue to make some progress. Okay? The first case, since there's only one thread, if it blocks, the whole application blocks. In this case, if one thread blocks, the application as a whole is not blocked if there are other threads that are ready to run. Okay? So here also you get blocking system calls, but you do get parallelism, which you didn't get in the first case. Okay, and the parallelism comes from having one thread run when some other thread of that process is blocked. Okay. Now the finite state machine approach tries to extract parallelism even when there's only one thread of control. So you take a traditional process, okay, not a multi-threaded one, a single-threaded process, okay, and you want to extract parallelism by just having one thread of control. And the way you do this, or the only way you can do this, is to make all I/O and all blocking calls non-blocking. Okay? So what would happen in this case, and this is why it's called event-based, is that if you have one thread of control, and you, let's say, make either a system call or you make some I/O call, you have to make that non-blocking, which means you just issue the request, and then the control is returned back to the process. Okay? And you continue executing something else. At some later point in time, that operation that you issued is going to complete and you will get interrupt. Okay, or you will get a signal and then you have to jump to some interrupt handler and get those results and process them. Okay? So if you have non-blocking calls, you can still do you can still extract parallelism even with one thread of control. And this is an event-based architecture. And we'll come back to this at some later point in time. So these are various ways you can write your application. You can write your application as a single-threaded process using blocking calls. You can write your application as a multi-threaded process also with blocking calls, but you get parallelism by using multiple threads. Or you write your application with non-blocking calls. Okay, and then you can do parallel execution. Is this clear?
Do you need hardware support for non-blocking?
Do you need hardware support? You don't need any hardware support to do event-based. You do need OS support to have non-blocking versions of all of these operations. Okay, so instead of write, you would do asynchronous write. Instead of read, you would do asynchronous read. So you need that support from the OS. Okay, so threads retain the idea of sequential execution with blocking call and yet achieve parallelism. Okay, now from a software engineering perspective, okay, we would claim that although these two do conceptually the same thing, they are extracting parallelism, writing a multi-threaded application is much simpler from a software engineering perspective than writing a finite state machine-based application. And the reason is here you are basically have to deal with basically a set of events and event handlers, which means that your code doesn't look sequential. But if you use a multi-threaded program, you're writing code that just looks similar to a single-threaded process, just that there are multiple threads of control. Okay? So it's much easier to understand what the application is doing because the code is still using a sequential execution model. In an event-based model, it's not a sequential execution model. As events are triggered, you're going to jump into event handlers and so on. So debugging is much harder and maintaining that code is much harder. Okay. Now let's take some examples of how you could design a multi-threaded web browser and a multi-threaded web server, and then we'll talk about thread scheduling next. Okay. Now most modern browsers tend to be multi-threaded in nature. Okay. Now, so what do threads in a browser do and how does this help? So if you think about a browser, there are many tasks a browser has to do. Okay, from the time you click on a link or specify a URL, it has to make a request on a network socket. It has to fetch the page, okay, whatever you requested, from a server, which is a remote server. When the page comes, you have to parse the page, okay, see what's in there. There may be embedded links in the page, embedded images. You have to make a request for each of those images, fetch them over a network socket. When those images come, you have to then render all of this on a screen. Okay? So these are the various tasks a typical browser would do. Okay? So that's what I mentioned here. So if you fetch, so as soon as you click on, let's say, an HTML page, you'll get the page. Then you will basically get all of the embedded images and you render. Now, in a multi-threaded browser, if you had a single-threaded browser, you would have to do all of these tasks sequentially. Okay? You first get the HTML page. When the page comes, let's say there are 10 images. Okay? You will set up an HTTP connection for the first image. Okay, first image comes over, then you go and fetch the second image and so on. So you'll do all of this sequentially. So users are going to see high response times because you are doing sequential processing of your page. Okay. If you had a multi-threaded browser, what it would do is once you fetch the first page, you will look at all of the embedded links, and then you can have one thread that starts up and it fetches each in parallel. If there are 10 images, you could have 10 threads set up 10 socket connections or 10 HTTP connections in parallel and start fetching them. Okay? And then each of them can render that image independently of the others. Okay, so if the second image arrives first, you can then start displaying it, meaning rendering it on the page while the first image is still coming down the network. Okay? So this gives you the notion of parallelism, okay, and helps you reduce response times. Okay? And this is how modern browsers optimize for good user experience. And the same is true if you have to set up connections to other sources. For example, your page may have an embedded ad. Right? So then you have to make a connection to the ad server and fetch the ad and display it or render it. So same can be done. You can have a different thread to do that. Okay? Is this clear? How a multi-threaded browser might work and how this gives you better response times? So, similar concepts can be applied to multi-threaded servers. Okay, so, if you have a single-threaded web server, if there are multiple client requests coming, you would have to sequentially service them one at a time. Okay, and this is going to increase the response times for your end users. Okay. Now, most servers that you will see will exploit multiple threads to reduce the response times. And what they would do is they use this notion of a thread per request model. Okay, what happens in a thread per request model is every incoming request is handed off to a new thread, and that thread is responsible for servicing that request independently of what other requests are doing in the system. So conceptually, whenever a new request comes in, you would start a new thread and assign it to that request, and when the thread is done servicing the request, it would terminate. Okay, this is referred to as I said, a thread per request model. Now, this does incur the penalty of thread creation and thread deletions for every single request. And high volume servers are going to receive hundreds of requests every second. So you would have to create and delete hundreds of threads. Okay? And that does incur penalty. So what most servers do is they will not really create a new thread whenever a new request arrives. Rather, they would use a pool of pre-spawned threads. Okay? So there is some pool of threads that are already spawned statically, okay, whenever the server starts up. And whenever a new request comes, there is a dispatcher thread. Okay, new request comes, and then the dispatcher thread has to look for an idle worker thread and just hand the request to it. Okay? So if your pool is sufficiently large, you will still be able to service all requests in parallel. But if you run out of worker threads, then requests have to wait here until a worker thread becomes available, and then you send it. Okay, so that's how servers would then get rid of your thread creation and thread deletion penalties. And each thread is using the standard blocking primitive. It is just servicing that request independently of everyone else. So if you have an HTTP server, you would basically go and start accessing your HTML or GIF or whatever file your browser is requesting from disk, fetch it from disk and send it back over a network as an HTTP response. Is this clear? Okay. So there are some optimizations here which I will talk very briefly, and that is how to decide what is the size of your worker's pool. Okay, how many threads do you want to keep in that pool? Okay, now most servers are going to, most modern servers like Apache for example, will decide that dynamically based on the load. Okay, so when you start up an Apache server, it may start, let's say, 10 worker threads depending on whatever the configuration file tells you. Okay, so now if you don't have many requests coming into system, that may be sufficient. Okay, but if your load goes up and you have lots of concurrent requests coming into the system, then you will quickly have queue built up here because all those 10 worker threads are going to be busy. Okay, so new request comes in, it has to wait for a worker thread to become available. Okay, so what Apache would do in this instance is whenever it sees that there are requests queuing up, it dynamically spawns additional worker threads. Okay, and increases the size of the worker pool. Okay, so if your entire worker pool is busy and new request comes in, it will spawn some more worker threads. Okay, so the pool keeps on increasing as the load goes up, and vice versa. Okay, if there are lots of idle threads and not enough workload, it will start deleting some. Okay, in other words, it just always tries to keep some spare worker threads available so that additional requests can be serviced. And this it does dynamically. And there is both a lower limit and an upper limit on the size of the worker pool so that you never fall below the lower limit. So you have some number of threads always ready. Neither do you go above the upper limit. Okay? And the upper limit is used mainly to prevent thrashing. Okay? Because if there is a huge surge, then you will get thousands of threads and that may basically cause the system to thrash. So you will put a limit on the number of threads you are willing to put in your worker pool. And if you reach that limit, at that point you have to start queuing up requests because you say you reach the maximum capacity, and spawning any more threads is going to cause the system to thrash. It means the performance will go down, not up, if you have more threads. Okay, so all of this can be controlled using configuration parameters, for example, in Apache. Okay, no question there?
Why not just work completely at a maximum level?
Okay, so why not just work at a maximum level? It just wastes resources, right? So every thread has to have some stack allocated for it. So your memory footprint is going to be much larger than you need to. Okay, so just more useful, better use of resources.
So is the other variable for optimization? Memory and number of threads?
Well, yes. It's not an optimization. It is just that you start a process. And if every Apache process had, let's say, the memory usage was 1 gig, even though you may be servicing one request an hour, that is wasteful, right? I mean, you don't need all of that unless the load goes up. So you just keep, you only increase the memory size as the load goes up and you really need that extra space to spawn new threads and allocate new stacks. So is this clear? Any questions here? Okay. So now we will actually, that was a quick overview of what multi-threaded applications can do with two examples. Now we'll talk about how to do thread scheduling and some of the issues that come up. Okay. So creation and deletion of thread, there is the static model where you can start with a pre-spawned pool, or dynamic model, purely dynamic, where every new request starts a new thread. Okay. So these are the two models that we just talked about. I have not talked about any of the critical sections or synchronization primitives, okay, because but those are very important in a multi-threaded application. Because threads are sharing variables or sharing parts of the address space. Whenever you have shared access, you need to use synchronization, either semaphores or locks or conditional synchronization primitives that allow you safe access. Okay? But if you are reading while someone else is writing, you're going to get incorrect results. Okay? This is a standard problem in any multi-threaded application. So you have conditional variables and spin locks which do busy wait or blocking locks or semaphore. Okay, so I'll assume that you know something about them. We'll not talk about them here. Okay, instead what we are going to talk about is two types of building thread libraries, kernel level threads and user level threads. And we'll see what does that mean from a scheduling standpoint in the operating system. Okay, so let's start with what are the things that we are concerned about when from a operating system standpoint. Cost of thread management is important. Okay, the lower it is, the more efficient your program is, because any of this is just pure overhead. The application is not doing anything useful. You're just wasting resources in doing context switch or thread creation or deletion. Okay, ease of scheduling is another important criteria. Okay, what does should the operating system know in order to schedule these threads well and give the application what it wants? Flexibility from a programming standpoint is another important issue. When you as an application designer writes a multi-threaded application, you may make some implicit assumptions on how these threads are going to get scheduled. Okay? Maybe your application works better if threads are scheduled using some scheduling algorithm versus another one. Okay? So giving some flexibility to the application designer is also important. And process blocking is another problem that you want to avoid. Okay, whenever the entire process blocks, your threads are not going to execute. So let's start with user level threads and see what they do, and then we'll talk about kernel level. Okay, now user level threads and the entire thread management is handled by a user level library. Okay, so the notion of a thread is implemented in the library, thread creation, thread deletion, all of this is done in a user level library. Okay, so the application just links against that library and it uses the functions provided by that library to create, delete and manage threads. Okay. Advantage here is that the kernel doesn't need to be modified to support the notion of a thread. Okay. In other words, you can implement the notion of a thread even if there is no kernel support. So this will work on lightweight embedded operating systems that do not have kernel support or old operating systems that did not implement or did not build in the notion of threads. Okay. This is very efficient from a thread creation, deletion and thread switching standpoint because no system calls are required here. Okay. Is that clear why? No system calls are involved in thread creation, deletion. Right. Because the entire threads library is a user library. Okay. Thread creation is a function call to that library, not a system call to the operating system. Okay, so clearly function calls are cheaper than system call, that much you should know. Right? So all of this is very efficient. There's no intervention from the kernel. You just do function calls to the thread library and you're done. And there is flexibility in scheduling. Because everything is in the library, scheduling of threads is also handled by this library. Okay, in other words, the scheduling algorithm is implemented in that library and can be changed. Okay, if you don't like library A, you can pick library B, which has a different scheduling algorithm. Or if it's an open source one, you can go and modify it on your own and put in a different scheduler. So in other words, scheduling of threads can be tailored to the application needs. If you are better off with FIFO scheduling versus FAIR scheduling, you can pick a library that gives you that. Okay. So that's important. Okay. Now disadvantage here is, the first disadvantage is that if any thread in a user level threads package blocks, all threads are going to block.
You mean if one thread I going to call one system call, then this process will be blocked?
Yes. So if one thread makes any blocking IO call, okay, the entire process blocks here. It's clear, right? Why? Because the kernel is not aware of the presence of threads. Okay, it only sees the entire thing as one process. The notion of a thread is only visible to the application. The kernel doesn't even know that there are threads and the kernel doesn't care. So it only sees one thread of control and that is what blocks, so the process is going to block. Okay, I'll show you a picture of how that works in just a moment. Okay. doesn't take advantage of multiprocessors. Okay, because if there are multiple processors, since the kernel only knows of this process as a single threaded process, the presence of threads is hidden from it. The kernel thinks there's only one thread of control, and it will only schedule this process on one CPU at a time. Okay? Even if multiple threads are ready to run, you only get to run on one CPU. You cannot take advantage of parallelism. Okay, because the notion of threads is hidden. It's all at the application level.
That's
okay,
brilliant.
Yes.
Linux PSLAT library belongs to this user level slash.
Right.
And now you change it to the kernel.
Correct. So the initial versions of pthreads in Linux and many other operating systems just implemented it as a user level library. But because of this disadvantages, some of them have switched to kernel level threads.
But can't you still be user level library and be able to make function calls to understand if there are multiple processes?
Yeah, so question is, can you understand whether you the kernel? So we'll talk about some hybrid models that will try to address some of these, but let's come to that in just a few slides. Okay. So here is an example of a user level thread. So here is your library as shown in gray. This is one process. Okay. There are three threads here, okay, and the library is scheduling them. But as far as the OS is concerned, it sees this entire blob as one process with one thread. Okay. Whenever this thread runs, the library scheduler. So scheduling is a two-level problem. First, the CPU scheduler in the kernel decides to run this process. And then the thread scheduler within the library has to decide which thread to run. Okay? And that thread gets to run. And so long as the quantum is available to you, this scheduler is free to do internal context switches and run some other thread and so on. Okay? And when the CPU says quantum is over, the entire process blocks. Okay? And then some other process gets to run. This is how you do scheduling in a user level threads package. Okay? This clear?
Okay. So that's what pthreads library do?
Okay. So question is that what pthreads library does? Pthreads is an API. It's a POSIX threads API. It doesn't specify implementation. Okay. Pthreads can be implemented either as a user level package or a kernel level package so long as the API is the same. Any application that you program against the API will work with that threads library. Okay. It is not, it's a specification as opposed to an implementation. Okay. So we'll get both library. Okay, so in the kernel level threads library, everything that you talked about in the user level is switched around, meaning that the kernel is aware of the presence of threads within the process. It knows precisely how many threads there are, can take advantage by scheduling these threads on different processors and so on. Yes, your question
here. Who creates the additional stacks?
Who creates the additional stacks? It is the job of the threads package also to create the additional. No, so you will have a segment that you will deal with yourself, right? So it's like you can, just as your heap segment that the malloc routine is going to manage, you will create a segment and you create a local stacks within that segment, and you just have to make the registers point to the right thing and it will work. Okay? Yes, your question.
Is it possible to have a preemption in user threads?
Is it possible to have preemption in user threads library? Yes, you can preempt. This is the library scheduler. It can preempt one thread, user level thread, and schedule another user level thread.
Using timer or,
yes, it will have to use a timer or some form of alarm to do this preemption.
But if the thread itself uses that timer, then there will be a conflict.
If the thread itself uses, so the thread scheduler is assumed to have its own state and own independent set of things that it uses to do the scheduling, which is independent from what the application is doing. Okay, you can have any number of timers, in other words. The thing that says you can only have one timer. So you will have your own set of timers or whatever else you are using to do the scheduling. Okay.
All the thread creation looks to be lightweight. In effect, all the package looks like behavior. Is it not separate timers, separate set of routines? Looks like there is a separate governing body which is kind of managing for each.
Yes.
You
are right. So each process will have a scheduler here, right? In the kernel level thread, all the scheduling is done here. So this is fairly lightweight. Not much happening here. Yes, a lot of the stuff is taken care of at the OS level. So yes, you gain something, you lose some. Now, in some cases, this is inevitable. If your kernel doesn't support threads, you have to do it this way if you want to write multi-threaded application. Think of lightweight operating system, embedded operating system that don't have this support. If you want multi-threaded support, you only do it using a threads library, a user level library. So yes, you will have some more overhead at the library level, but there is nothing that the kernel needs to support. Okay. Here's a picture of a kernel level threads package. As you can see, each thread here corresponds to some entity that the kernel knows about. Okay. And so if there are two of these, so here is an example where this application where there are three threads but two are runnable and these two are actually running on two CPUs, okay, at the same time. So you actually get parallelism. Multiple threads of the same application can run in parallel on multiple CPUs and you will get the benefits of parallelism. So all of the disadvantages that we articulated here, okay, become advantages, advantages become disadvantages. Okay. The kernel level threads library, one thread can block, but other threads can run because the kernel knows about them. If they're ready to run, they will run. Okay, you can take advantage of multiprocessor. There is no flexibility in scheduling because you are stuck with whatever CPU scheduler the kernel is providing. Okay, you end up using that. Okay, less efficient because thread creation and thread deletions are system calls because this kernel needs to allocate internal data structures for this thread and needs to be aware of them. All of these become system calls, so the overhead is higher. Okay? And you do need to modify the kernel to be aware of threads, okay, within a process. So those are what kernel level threads do, and as is shown in this picture. Okay? Now this is clearly better for multiprocessors. Okay? Because if you know multiprocessor, if you are user level threads, you're not going to take advantage of the multiple CPUs. Yes, question.
Is the thread creation as heavy as process creation, or it's lighter than that?
No. So all types of thread creations are lighter than process creation, as we mentioned, because you don't need to load the whole process. Process is already loaded. Okay, you just need to allocate a new stack. Now, whether the kernel is allocating that stack for you or it's a user level thread, it's still more lightweight operation than you start an application, you load it from disk into memory, all that you avoid here. Okay, so all of the advantages we talked about apply to both from a process standpoint. Now, there was some question that was raised here, which was, can you get some benefits of both? So there are modern operating systems that try to generalize this notion, okay? Meaning that there are two extremes you talked about, user level threads and kernel level threads. And they try to get the benefits of both. And this is done using the notion of what's called a lightweight process or LWP. Okay? In particular, Solaris, which is Sun's operating systems, uses a lightweight process, and so do some other versions of Linux. Okay, so what happens here, or the way you get some benefits without losing all of them, is that lightweight processes are entities that the kernel knows about. But there is a user level threads package that also has the notion of threads. Okay, how you map threads within an application to lightweight processes at the kernel level allows you to get the benefits of either a pure user level threads package or a pure kernel level threads package or something in between. Okay, so here is a picture that shows you how this would work. Okay, so in this case, there is the kernel which has its own scheduler. There's also a library, okay, that implements a scheduling. It's not really a scheduler, but it implements a mapping of its own. Okay, now every process, okay, what we think of a process will have multiple threads as the user level. Okay, so here are 3 and this is 5 and this is 3. Okay. Now what does the kernel know about? So at the kernel level, every process has some number of lightweight processes attached to it. Okay. A lightweight process is a schedulable entity. It's an entity that can be scheduled on the CPU. Okay. How these user level threads map onto lightweight processes depends on the particular scenario. Okay. If you have a one-to-one mapping, which means for every thread at the user level, your one thread at one lightweight process at the kernel level, you come to the pure kernel level threads. Okay, that's what happened in this picture. For every thread here, there was something here. Okay, there's a pure one-to-one mapping. Okay. If you have a many-to-one mapping, which means that there is only one lightweight process for the entire application, as is shown in this picture. Okay, this degenerates to a pure user level threads packet because you will, at any point in time when this runs, the library scheduler will dynamically map one of these threads to that. Okay, and if that blocks, then you're stuck. Okay. Now, you can have many-to-many mappings where you may have, in this case, you have 5 user-level threads and you have 2 lightweight processes. Okay? And then maybe these 3 get mapped to the first one and these 2 get mapped to the second one. Okay? So then you are multiplexing, you are sort of a slightly more coarse grain than a one-to-one mapping, but you are not at the user level. So you can create lightweight processes and destroy them dynamically as well, depending on the scheduling needs of the application.
What's the advantage of such as M-to-M
So what's the advantage? This gives you a lot of benefits. From an application designer, you can actually specify how many lightweight processes you want. Do you want full parallelism or is it fine to multiplex these two? So you can use a lot of application level knowledge to optimize your resources in the system. You will increase the complexity, but you get some of the benefits of a user level threads package that you lost when you did kernel level. In kernel level threads, you are stuck with this, whatever the OS is doing. Here you get some benefits. Okay? And Solaris actually goes one step further. It basically can dynamically decide how many lightweight processes to attach to a process. Okay? When you start up, you get one lightweight process. Okay? Even if you do multiple pthread creates and create a number of threads, until it sees that some of these threads are all runnable at the same time, it is not going to create additional LWPs. But if it sees that there are multiple threads ready to run and there's only one lightweight process, it will dynamically spawn another one and try to give you parallelism. So it even varies the number of lightweight processes to match the behavior of the application. And the application designer can also control it and attach certain threads to lightweight processes and so on. Okay? So this is a hybrid, think of it as a hybrid approach that can look like one or the other or something in between. And you can actually, as an application designer, decide how you want your application to behave. Yes, there's a question there.
So you mentioned that Solaris, like you said, that can basically has to match the number of lightweight processes with the number of user level threads.
Right.
So this means that it needs to know about the user level threads.
Yes. So, exactly. So what happens in Solaris is when you do pthread create, there is an additional flag you can pass on saying that I'm creating a new thread. You can please start a new lightweight process for this. Okay? So pthread create is a system call. The kernel will know about it. So it knows how many user level threads there are at the kernel level. All it needs to know is when you start a new user level thread, should I start yet another lightweight process or not? Should I keep the current number of lightweight process and have the multiplex on it? You can use this thread to create a new one, or you can let the kernel dynamically decide whether it wants to create one on its own.
So there is still some kind of system call involved when you're doing the thread creation.
Yes.
So what are the advantages of the lightweight thread?
Yes, absolutely. So here all thread creation deletions are exposed to the kernel. So they are system calls. So it's not as lightweight. What you have gotten advantages from a scheduling standpoint, which is what one advantage of user level threads, that you could pick any library that gave you what you wanted from the scheduler. Okay.
So are these lightweight processes much easier to create and delete than normal processes because they handle less
yes.
number
of threads? So lightweight processes are exactly the same as what you do at the in the kernel level thread, except that more than one user level threads can be mapped on. But otherwise they are the same. So they will be cheaper to create than a process, for example. Okay. So again, here decision to do scheduling is two level. Okay. Whenever a lightweight process runs, at the user level threads library, you have to look for a runnable thread that's mapped onto it, and you pick one of them to run. Okay. So that's basically what is shown in this picture here. So here is a case where this lightweight process is running on that CPU. And basically, this thread essentially gets to run on this because that gets mapped to that lightweight process. Okay? And you can swap those mapping depending on what that thread does and so on at the user level. Any questions here? All right. So the last thing I want to talk about is thread packages, which some of you probably know already. So there are two that are very common. Okay. Depending on the programming language you use. So if you use C++, POSIX threads, also called pthreads, are very common. Okay, most operating systems support them. Linux, there are Windows implementations of POSIX threads as well as Macs and other operating systems. And it's a well-known standard. So once you program your application to a pthreads package, you can port that application to another platform so long as pthreads is supported on that platform. So it gives you the advantage of portability, and pthreads is widely used. So the applications, once you write them in pthread, do run on a number of platforms. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, pthread is a specification. It has a set of APIs like pthread create, pthread delete, and so on, that it specified, but it doesn't say how to implement it. Okay? That is left to the library designer. You can implement it both as a user level thread or a kernel level thread, pthreads package, and you will get combination both depending on what platform you use and what library you are using. Okay? And then the other side of things, if you use Java, then Java already has the notion of threads built into the language. Okay? So you can use Java threads to implement whatever you're doing. And here what happens is the threads are managed by the JVM, as opposed to at the kernel level, whatever we think of the JVM as the equivalent to your kernel. So your application has, there's a Java app has some threads, all of them get used or rather managed by the Java virtual machine. Okay, it decides which thread to run, which thread not to run, and so on. And it might itself create some schedulable entities or lightweight processes in the kernel if it wants real parallelism. Okay, that's up to the JVM, the specific JVM implementation. Okay, so JVM acts as your threads pack manager in a Java in the Java world, and that's what it what you use to do the scheduling.
Still a two-level.
Yes, very much. So this question is this a two-level? Very much is, because you have your Java app, and there is the JVM. This runs as one process. Okay, this is the kernel. So the kernel is actually going to schedule the JVM. The JVM will pick one of the user level threads and run. Okay? And then the JVM may create multiple lightweight processes so that if there are two CPUs, these two will run on two CPUs and two Java threads at the application level will run. But that's up to the JVM, how it interacts with the kernel. Okay? So you probably will use some notion of threads in your first assignment. Okay, I'm not going to specify which package or which language, that I will leave to you, but some of these concepts you probably will use them, okay, to optimize your application. So as far as today is concerned, this is where we will stop. Next time I'm going to go back to distributed scheduling. So we started with uniprocessor scheduling, we did multi-threaded scheduling, but we are still within one machine. Okay, all these threads are running on a single machine. So next time we look at the application is now spread across machines. How do you do scheduling in that world? Okay, that's in the next class. Okay, so let's stop here. As I mentioned, if some of you came late, there is a homework that's put up on the webpage. Try to turn it in by Friday or so. Okay, you can email it to the TA directly.
In fact, I think one important disadvantage of user level model.